You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond, broadcasting live here from the Sunny Cultural District in downtown Fairfield, Iowa.
Sunny is right.
Sunny, and we have our solar-powered solar panels charging away out there.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, it's cold. It's brisk out today, but I've been told that the sun produces just as much electricity on a cold day as on a hot day.
Really?
Yeah, or at least here in Iowa, because that we can actually produce as much electricity in the winter as in the summer,
mm-hmm.
because we don't have the trees blocking things and so forth. So I don't know if it were apples to apples, if it would be the same, or if the heat makes a difference.
Well, I know is when the sun is shining, it doesn't seem as cold outside.
That is true, unless the wind's really blowing.
Yeah, right.
So, this is Writer's Voices.
Yes.
And I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn. And it has been a few weeks since we've been live in the studio. Caroline did a show without me while I was gone visiting my daughter in L.A. and had a Jerry Yellen here in the studio, and that was a really wonderful show. If you missed that, he was talking about veterans and combat veterans and the impact on their psyches, basically, from being in combat and how transcendental meditation can help with that. But he had lots of war stories, World War II stories that he shared in that interview, which you can catch on writersvoices.com or KRUUFM.com.
Yes, it was great. It was a great interview. It really was. Not from my standpoint, but
because
he was great.
And we have another really interesting topic today.
Oh, my, I should say.
Caroline, do you want to introduce today's guest?
Okay, it's Barry Spector, the author of Madness at the Gates of the City. Doesn't that sound interesting? The Myth of American Innocence. And, Gary is a staff member with the Redwoods Men's Center in Santa Rosa, California, and that mission is to recognize the need for men to come together in community to express and explore ideas which restore wholeness to themselves and soul to the world. That's a great endeavor. And for this book, he received the 2011 Penn Oakland Josephine Miles Literary Award, and it's a most interesting book, and you're going to be greatly enlightened, I'm sure.
Welcome to Writer's Voices, Barry.
Thank you for having me on. It's good to talk to some folks in the heartland from out here on the West Coast.
Yeah, have you ever lived in this part of the world?
I lived a little bit in Boise, Idaho about 35 years ago, but I'm from the East Coast originally.
Ah, okay. And I do want to mention that the blurb on the cover of your book says, strikingly imaginative, this is truly an original work from Howard Zinn, who is a very, of course, well-known writer, historian. How in the world did you get him to read and discuss your book? Are you friends?
I didn't know Howard personally, but of course I'd been greatly influenced by his writings, and I was just fortunate enough to get his attention and have him take a look at some of my writing and be willing to look at the manuscript of the book. And he wrote me that blurb just a couple of months before he died.
Wow. Madness at the Gates of the City. Why this book?
Well, let me just say a word or two about the title. My background is 20 years of studying Greek mythology, and also, as your mother mentioned, 20 years of working with men in the men's movement. But the phrase "madness at the gates of the city" it comes from one of the great tragic dramas of ancient Greece from about 400 BC. It's the story of the Bacchae by Euripides, in which the god Dionysus, who represents this great irrational force coming in from the outside and who was not tolerated by the patriarchal and rigid and puritanical forces controlling the city. Dionysus forces his way in just as alcohol does. He is the god of of the wine and god of madness, but also the god of group communal ecstasy, and he's everything that the patriarchal misogynist and puritanical culture represses. So in the story, he literally breaks down the walls and forces his way into the city and forces those who would not accept him to realize that he is part of themselves. So that's the background to this notion of the book. And of course, when I was reading reading this story, the relevance of it as a metaphor to American culture just struck me immediately. And so I spent 10 years researching and writing the book with this idea in mind.
What drew you to the study of mythology in the first place?
I had crises, midlife crisis of my own, maybe 20-odd years ago, and I was just lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time and to be influenced by certain teachers of mythology and poets in particular. And something worked for me at that moment in my life where I could see that what we really need to do is think mythologically. That in fact, that our and as I've come to feel more and more that our contemporary conventional political and economic and even theological teachers and ways of thinking have failed us in our to help explain our how we got into the crisis we're in now and how to get out of it. And it seems to me that mythological thinking gives us a much broader perspective that will allow us to situate ourselves in the great big stories in our culture and in our personal lives, and perhaps help us with that broader perspective, help us to see new ways of thinking.
What is myth? Let's just start with the very basics here.
Sure. Of course, in the most common idea is that myth is something not true. But I think hopefully a lot of your listeners will already be familiar perhaps with the work of Joseph Campbell and writers like that. So we need to get past that kind of thinking right away, and because there is so much more that we can know about ourselves by approaching myth. So myths may or may not be literally true. Some academics take enormous lengths to come to definitions of what myth is, but I try to keep it simple and in plain English. To me, myths are the stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves. So they speak to our unresolved conflicts and needs and fantasies. They give us meaning, and they tell us who we are. Now, in indigenous cultures and tribal cultures and ancient cultures with functioning mythologies, myths and the rituals associated with them rooted everyone in the recurrent cycles of nature and in the great mysteries of being. And the myths helped initiate and welcome the children into the world and connect them to the deep mysteries. And these myths provided stories by which cultures could begin to perceive the unique individual essence of each person and the gifts that each person comes into the world with, and to help welcome everyone into the world and situate them in these stories of great meaning. Now, unfortunately, it seems to me that for a very, very long time now, modern culture has been in what Joseph Campbell called a demythologized world, where the myths have broken down, and what we have left with are literalized versions of the myths. let me explain what I mean. The simplest way to think of that is to think in terms of a fundamentalist religion, where people take stories that were told 2,000 and 3,000 years ago and which are filled with metaphor and nuance and symbolism, and they take them quite literally. So in other words, somebody who says that the world was born in, you know, the world was made in 7 days, is taking the story of Genesis literally, when in fact the story of Genesis is a wonderful mythological tale, and it's really speaking about the human soul, not about some construction event that happened 7,000 years ago. So that's one example of how we take myths literally now as modern people. But I would also suggest that our consumer culture and our addiction to materialism is also a kind of the mirror opposite of that way of thinking, and so it's also a way of literalizing our mythologies.
Hmm. So are old wives' tales part of the part of our culture in myth? You know what I'm talking about?
You know, again, academics go to great lengths to define, make distinctions between folk tales, legends, popular culture, and things like that. To me, it all fits together in a great big mythological mix.
Mm-hmm.
So some tales are just, you know, they're teaching tales about morality, but what I'm concerned with are the great myths that we all share as Americans and as modern people, and to the most and for the most part we do that quite unconsciously. And in other words, if you are part of a mythic belief system, everything about our story seems perfectly self-evident and obvious, and we never question them.
Mm-hmm.
But for somebody who's outside of our mythic bubble, so to speak, looking in, everything is open for question, because they don't. Somebody outside the bubble doesn't share the same belief systems.
That's really interesting, because everyone thinks that their own beliefs are true and everybody else's are myth.
Well, yeah, you know, it's common to speak about how American life is polarized these days between so-called left and so-called right, you know, on the political spectrum. But to me, if we take that broader perspective and look into America from outside the mythological bubble, from my point of view, almost all Americans, regardless of their political stance, share an essential agreement of belief in what I call the myth of American innocence.
Let's delve into that a little more. That, what is the myth of American innocence? How did it, where did it come from, and how do you relate it to Greek mythology?
Excellent questions, and I'll try to take a few minutes to give you the bigger picture. Now, as I spoke about Greek myth, I was speaking about that story of the Bacchae by Euripides about the god Dionysus. Now, just a few words on the psychological spectrum first. To me, what Dionysus represents is the other. In other words, the part of our soul, of our psychology, and also of our culture that is very fundamental to who we are, but which for some reason or other we won't allow into awareness. So what do we do typically is we project that unaccepted parts of ourselves onto convenient scapegoats. So Dionysus served as a mythological base for scapegoating in Greek culture. But when we look at modern culture, the scapegoating that we do is as Americans is often about, as I said, the parts of ourselves that we can't bring to our own awareness. And I would say that that has to do with our physical bodies, our sexuality. reality, and our the parts of ourselves that don't want to be fit into rational boxes, so to speak. And so that's why, as the god of wine, Dionysus was said to loosen the walls of, so to speak, of the ego, as well as the walls of the city. So, but in modern culture, without the great myths that used to hold us together, we, as I said, we do all this literally. And so, for hundreds and hundreds of years, maybe thousands of years, in Europe, the great scapegoat was the Jew inside the culture. And the great scapegoat outside of the culture was the Muslim. Mm-hmm. In other words, for 800 years or so, Christians were obsessed with white European Christians were obsessed with this fear of the Muslim other who was attacking Europe for many hundreds of years. So when English and Spanish colonizers came to North America, they came with a long heritage of this repression of parts of themselves which they had been projecting upon other people. So our Puritan ancestors, especially in New England, very quickly, within a very short period of time, found an image to project that they could project upon in the Native Americans. And they saw the Native Americans as barbarians, as subhuman, as hypersexual, as savages, and then within a few generations, of course, white English colonists began importing tens of, and then hundreds of thousands of Africans to this continent, what they did was they projected so much of their unacceptable parts of themselves onto black people. And I think what happened was within the first century of the American or the English presence on this continent, a mythology began to develop, which I call the myth of American innocence. In other words, what was happening was a continent was being conquered, and millions of people, red and black, were being subjugated or killed. I mean, there was a tremendous genocide. Some people say that there were 150 million people in North and South America before the invasion of the whites, the vast majority of whom died. So I think what happened in America was that in a very short time, Americans, or even before they were considered Americans, white people had to evolve a set of ideas about themselves that allowed them to live with the realities of their own of their presence on the continent, and so white colonists came to believe that all innocence was within the walls of the city, so to speak, and that all evil was outside. Mm-hmm. And so, the Native Americans as attacking them for no reason whatsoever.
Yeah.
So this is how the story of innocence began to grow. And I'm sorry if I took a long time here, but I felt I needed to give a little background.
Oh yeah.
But
right.
I think these are we began to evolve many, many stories in which we conveyed to each generation in America this notion of innocence, so that we could live with the facts with the actual facts of who we were on this continent, and then later, of course, on other continents.
Wow. So fast forward, and how is this getting played out today, and particularly in regards to the Occupy Wall Street movement?
Thank you. Another great question. Well, it seems to me that, again, let me give you a little bit more background. It seems to me that these stories about who we are as innocent white Americans took many, many generations to evolve. But we've been telling ourselves these stories for perhaps 20 generations, perhaps 400 years, certainly at least 300 years. And these stories have allowed us to live, as I said, with the effects of American imperialism and American racism. And at the same time, there have been many periods in American history when either the economic or the political situation broke up to some extent, and cracks began to appear in these stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves. And I think that the decade of the 1960s was the greatest example of that. And I think the reactionary response that occurred in the 70s that led up to Ronald Reagan's election in 1980, as I said, were a response to this crack in the myth. I think another great crack appeared in the myth just prior to 2000, when, if you may recall, there were great demonstrations against the World Trade Organization all across the country and all across the world.
So, Barry, when you say a crack in the myth, do you mean that a large number of people no longer accept the myth and try to point out that?
Well, I would also suggest, first of all, that so-called minorities in this country have always been the folks who have questioned the myth primarily. In fact, I came across a great quote attributed to, I forget his name now, he's an African-American science fiction writer. He said that, he said this a couple of years after 9/11. He said he had never met an African-American who had been surprised at the attack on the World Trade Center. So clearly, minorities who have been the brunt of these issues that I've been talking about have been less likely to
buy in.
Buy in, so to speak.
Yeah.
But also, large numbers of white people. You know, in the 1930s, I mean, there was tremendous political demonstration and organizing against capitalism in America. And then, so I think when I speak about cracks appearing in the myth, I'm suggesting people, large numbers of people, begin to question not just the political and economic issues, which are to me are kind of the most the simplest ways of looking at it, but questioning the deeper questions that the issues that we've led our lives by. And so I see now in the Occupy movement, or let me put it this way, my hope for the Occupy movement is that in the various meetings and assemblies that are going on all across the country as we speak, that people are not we being limited to the questions of politics and economics. I mean, clearly thousands, maybe millions of people are coming to these discussions because they've lost their homes and they've lost their jobs. But you know, just below that is a deeper question. They've lost their dreams. They've lost their hopes about the American dream. But even below that, there are many other questions. Questions having to do with aspects of the myth of American innocence, such as ideas of progress and ideas of infinite growth. For example, I forget if it was the poet Gary Snyder or the environmentalist writer Edwin Abbey. One of them said, think about this notion of infinite growth, for example. The only place in nature where infinite growth appears is in a cancer cell. So what these guys are talking about is, I think, is extremely relevant to what I'm hoping people are talking about at the Occupies. For example, everybody wants to have a job, and of course, everybody should have the right to a job. But should it be any kind of job, or should it be meaningful work, work that expresses their own unique gifts that they want to bring into the world? And if we had full employment, and if we had again this notion of a constantly expanding economy, is it at all possible to have something like that and have a sustainable environment at the same time? And these questions have divided environmentalists from labor union activists for 40 years now. that we have to address them at this point. And that's why I'm hoping that the conversations at the Occupies are going deeper than just questions of how do we get a bigger slice of the American pie. Mm.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Barry Spector, author of Madness at the Gates of the City, The Myth of American Innocence. Caroline, did you have a...
Yeah, I was going to say, one of the things they were saying about the Occupy Wall Street groups is that they didn't seem to have any definite leadership. And that is that a problem? That can be a problem, maybe, for them? What do you think?
Well, it seems too early to tell. I think one of the messages that are coming out universally, not just even in this country, but in Occupies all across the country, is that the political system itself is broken, and the economic system is broken, and to put forward leaders who are demanding specific reactions from specific politicians may not be what we want. I mean, I think what they're potentially asking is that we need to reassess the whole picture.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of individual leaders may be part of that broken system at this point. I mean, clearly millions of people are deeply disappointed and disillusioned with Barack Obama right now, and I feel like there's been anything creative offered by the Republicans, but people don't want to just. I think a lot of people just don't want to elect Democrats now. They want to look at the big picture and see why has this system allowed two political parties that are both pretty much resistant to listening to the needs of the people.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think part of our American myth or story that we tell about ourselves is we glorify the concept of democracy as the rule of the people, and we glorify the voice of the people. And yet here we have a movement where it's a whole bunch of people, and we're saying, oh, but you have to have a leader. You know, a leader is not actually part of the concept of democracy. And we talk about not having the right leaders and not having good leaders. Well, if we really believe in the power of the people, then it's everybody's responsibility. It's like we almost want to shift everything off to say, oh, well, the leaders will take care of us and we don't have to think about it. But here are all these people who say, no, we want to think about it. We don't want to give our power over to a leader.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, you know, when we think about the big myths in the culture, much of what we're doing as individual people is giving up our own power to big pictures of individual people. You know, we do that in the cult of celebrity, for example.
Oh yeah.
I was just reading an interesting book about the O.J. Simpson trial, for example, when for a couple of years it seemed like the whole culture was obsessed with this one individual, but just below that was what this one individual was representing in the minds of the culture. And you know, and we do that with politicians. And I think, you know, we want, you know, let me backtrack a little toward indigenous and ancient cultures for a second. I think what indigenous and tribal cultures offered was a great range of a polytheistic culture where there were many images of divinity. And they represented aspects of who we were. And when Western culture tried to compress all of that down into a monotheistic figure of one with one individual, it was impossible to try to squeeze all of human potential into one image. And I think that's that's one reason why people get so disillusioned in leaders, is because we are projecting what we used to see in the pagan gods, we now see in celebrities. And
yeah.
when a celebrity proves to be all too human, and to you know, to have to be imperfect, our common response is disillusionment, and even, you know, going all the way over to the other side of idealization, it goes to demonization. It's because what we do unconsciously is project these mass great big parts of who we are as human beings, and we try to see that in a perfect form in some exterior figure, whether it's a celebrity or a politician, and we are inevitably disappointed.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Barry Spector, author of Madness at the Gates of the City, The Myth of American Innocence. And we're talking about some of the great American myths, how they're not really being acknowledged. And Barry, it seems to me that part of your point is that if we can acknowledge the myths and how they're playing out, that we have an opportunity to change the story.
That is true, and I would ask if we could maybe save that part of the discussion for the last part of the
sure,
show, because
sure.
it seems to me like we really need to spend more time really looking at who we have been before we can begin to ask questions of who we might be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I haven't had a chance actually to define the myth of innocence. Could I take a minute to do that?
Yes, please.
As I see it, the myth of American innocence is a 400-year series of narratives, that is, novels, songs, children's stories, political rhetoric, sermons, films, advertisements, etc., that justify American capitalism, racism, imperialism, and environmental destruction by blaming its victims, removing all guilt and responsibility from both its perpetrators and its beneficiaries. It is the systematic manufacture of consent based upon terror of the other. Now, of course, for the last 20 years, the other that we have been most terrorized by has been the image of Middle Eastern so-called terrorism, and also the image of immigration, of people coming across the borders, you know, literally through the walls of the city. So now, in these stories, the primary concepts referred to are freedom, opportunity, individualism, and competition. So the story tells us that the individual is a blank slate who is free to become anything he or she wants to be. And paradoxically, this nation of individuals with no inborn purposes...
That's just the train in the background.
Huh.
Outside our window.
Okay. Did you catch that last part?
No. Can you repeat that?
Paradoxically, this nation of individuals with no inborn purposes is an individual among nations with a divine purpose to bring freedom to the rest of the world. And I would suggest that this story is subscribed to in deep unconscious ways by almost all Americans, liberals no less than conservatives. So a couple of aspects of what makes America unique in our thinking about America. No other nation, said Howard Zinn, has gone to such lengths to define itself by excluding so many from full membership, including rigid legal systems deliberately intended to divide natural allies, while simultaneously telling itself pervasive stories of freedom and opportunity. And only Americans, in my thinking, only Americans have justified invasion and massive violence with stories of idealism and good intentions. So this is an aspect of our innocence that, as part of our national story, when we think of when we ponder what America, and I'll be straight about it, what I would call the American Empire has done in the world, we are forced to create stories and remind ourselves that it's just not like that. You know, the United States has actually attacked since the end of World War II, has attacked some 45 or 46 countries. So it's you know, if we look at the dark facts, it's too uncomfortable. It's too painful, and so we have to cover up the facts in a sense, so that we can live with who we are. And what we do is we create these stories of our good intentions.
Now, Barry, I want a couple things. One is, is there a source for that 45, 46 countries that the United States has attacked?
I do have a source in my book. I have a footnote. It would be hard to pull it out right now.
All right. So if you want to...
If anybody wanted to email me on that, we can give information like that later on, and I'll be happy to...
Great. And then I'm wondering, I mean, there certainly have been people, and always are people who speak out and say, hey, this is wrong, this isn't, you know, we aren't innocent. Of course, I would say Howard Zinn is probably one of those who has been most successful at getting an audience for what he's saying. And I did want to mention that on KRUU next Thursday at 7 p.m., on Tanner and Moore, James Moore will continue his reading of Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States with Chapter 11, Robber, Baron, and Rebels. So if you want to hear more about Howard Zinn, that's a good place to tune in and find out. So there are people saying this, and what happens to them?
Well, I think Noam Chomsky has been the best writer in this particular issue. He's spoken, written quite a bit about American intellectuals and academics, and especially the media, and especially the major media in this country, have created, in a sense, walls of acceptable debate, so that if everybody more or less agrees that we are free to argue about these issues, but the media, present company accepted. I'm speaking
about the major media
and the major newspapers and so on, but especially television. But if the media subtly creates boundaries beyond which certain things simply can't be discussed, then within those boundaries, people can argue and feel like we have freedom of expression. You know, Chomsky, mm-hmm. for example, is considered one of the greatest intellectuals of the 20th and 21st century, and he's been barred almost completely, and Howard Zinn as well, from any political talk shows. I mean, he's almost never been on any political talk shows, even though he's one of the best-selling authors in the country.
Wow.
But, you know, that's just one example, and I don't really want to leave any listener with the impression that we're speaking, that I'm only speaking about the political level. I mean, I think that really that's the most, as I said, the most, the easiest way to speak about it. But the repression of the truth and the repetition of these stories would not be so powerful if they did not fall on fertile ground. In other words,
right?
There is a great big part of our American psyche that wants to hear these stories. And if I could, can I delve into American history a little bit here to tell you a little bit more about the stories themselves?
Sure. Is there a section from your book that you'd want to read about this?
Well, I'm pretty much just speaking from the book anyway.
Okay.
Have you ever heard about the phrase captivity narratives? It's a very interesting concept.
No.
About 1680 in New England, the very first of these narratives was published, and it was a story of a young, good-looking, probably blonde, white woman who had been captured by the Native Americans and had somehow either escaped or her freedom had been traded for or something, and she wrote a book about her experiences among the natives, And this was called, this was the first of the captivity narratives. Now, what's interesting is that for the next 50 years, well into the 18th century, all but one of America's top-selling books were captivity narratives.
Wow.
And then by the middle, by the late 17th century and going big time into the early 18th century, there were hundreds and then eventually thousands and then eventually tens of thousands of stories, often in the format of the dime novels of the Western heroes, but also about detectives, and then going into the 20th century in film and in the notion of the superheroes, for example. These stories of an innocent community symbolized by a young, beautiful, virginal, blonde woman being attacked or threatened or captured for no reason whatsoever by this immense evil force outside of the community. This was the basic story that Americans told themselves throughout the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. And I mentioned the O.J. Simpson trial, for example, because that was a fairly recent expression. It's not exactly the same story, but it was tapping into this this kind of mythic receptivity on the part of the American psyche. In other words, to put it back into the political context, for 300 or 400 years, Americans have been, or should I say, the white Americans and white politicians have been using this story of the fear of the dark, terrible other to motivate people, not in terms of their better nature, but in terms of their fears. This story is just as strong now. I mean, do you remember the story of in the invasion of Iraq in 2003 of what was her name? Oh, I forget her name, but it was a young American woman soldier who had been captured by the Iraqis, and it made front page news. It actually blotted out aspects of the war itself for several days, because here was this a 2003 version of the same captivity narrative, and what it did on the emotional level, its impact on the emotional level for countless people, unfortunately, was to justify the war. In other words, in many people's minds, we were there in Iraq to rescue this woman who had been captured by these bad guy Iraqis, even though she was part of an invading force. But on the emotional level, on the psychological and mythological level, the truth doesn't matter. When demagogues are trying to motivate people by fear, they have a long tradition of these mythic stories to tap into, and I'd like to also suggest that for some 40 years now, the Republican Party has been absolutely mythically literate and totally and completely conversant in these concepts that I'm talking about. And if we look at how they've been motivating people for these last 40 years in particular, I think you'll see that it's very consistent with what I'm talking about. Meanwhile, I feel that the Democrats have been almost completely clueless on this matter, which is to say that in a typical debate on TV or in a town hall somewhere, when a Democrat or a progressive of some sort tries to show people the facts and speak on a rational and intellectual level, they are speaking to the head, not to the body. Whereas the Republicans can bypass the head and go directly to the gut with these stories of fear of the terror of the other, whether it's about terrorism, the war on terror, or it's about immigration. People come to take our jobs, if not our daughters. And these stories go directly to the gut, if not further south.
But how do you argue or how do you debate that point if you want to use facts, if you're trying to point out that these fears are not grounded in reality? How can you do that without speaking to the head?
You know, that's a great question, and I don't have any good answers. I think in the long run, it will require reframing some of our stories. And I think, for example, one of the brilliant things that the Occupy people have come up with is this notion of the 99%.
Right, which isn't real either. You know, it isn't true that 99% agree with the Occupy protesters.
Oh no! But when they're saying we are the 99%, they're speaking in terms of the economy and what the
disenfranchised,
hyper rich have relative to the rest of us. But I think what they're trying to do is bypass to some extent bypass the intellectual and move more toward reframing the big stories themselves.
Right.
At the same time, I want to tell you a startling statistic, because this speaks again to the mythological issues that we're talking about here. Now, this is 20 years old. This is a statistic I found from approximately 1991 or so. At that point, a large number of Americans were asked questions about relevant to the same conversation, and it turned out at that point, 19% of Americans believed that they were in the top 1%. and I'm not done here.
Okay.
Further 19% believed that someday they would be among the top 1%. So in other words, 38%, nearly 2 out of 5 Americans, were, in a sense...
deluded?
Buying into, with deep emotion, believers in a story of progress and an American dream that of course is you know, if we look at it logically, is totally irrational. But part of the reason why so many people resist notions of taxing the rich, for example, is because large numbers of us still think that someday we'll be among the rich. In fact, some people think that we are among the rich, even if they're, you know, even if we're just middle class.
Right, but and even so, it doesn't really make sense, because if you think you're going to have that much money someday, you should know that you don't actually need that much to live a really good life, because you're living a really good life now. And so,
that goes back to my hopes for the Occupy movement that they're looking at. That they'll be asking much deeper questions, like what is the meaning of a life? Is it to you know, die with the most toys, or is it to live?
To help the most people.
Yeah, and to live in an interconnected web of community, and to give the gift your unique gift that you came into the world to offer.
I think the reality of the immigration thing hit Alabama when the workers in the field left because of the new laws down there, and so the crops are rotting in the field because white Americans don't want to work that hard in the field.
Right, you're right. Yeah, that's a really interesting situation that's happening down there.
You know, I've been thinking a lot lately about the concept of enough, and how much is enough, and why do people who, you know, who really have a lot still sometimes keep trying and striving for more. And sometimes it's just a matter of, you know, the money is the way to keep score. It's all a game, and the more money you make, that means that you're winning the game, and the money itself doesn't really matter. But to some extent, and I think for myself, as I've been more financially successful, and I stopped to think, okay, so when would I feel like I had enough?
Right.
And I realized that it's all, like, I have enough now, but there's always this fear that I might lose it. And so I have to get more, so I have more of a cushion.
Yeah.
So that I don't have that fear.
I spoke earlier about the idea that we live in a demythologized world. And, you know, what we have, instead of the great myths that, that once held culture together, we have these stories of, especially in America, of individualism and stories that support capitalist notions and notions of perpetual growth and always wanting more. But also, I think when we have a demythologized world, we have a deeply diminished imagination about potential really is. And if all that we're being offered are these stories of get rich and get ahead, and we don't have any other stories, you know, alternate stories that offer other visions, then we get stuck in mm-hmm. these stories. And then again, you know, you put it yourself. You said part of that story is the fear that you might lose it.
Right. Right.
That ties in with what I've been saying about mythic tales of terror of the other, because who are we going to lose it to, for example? Is it about crime, or to be honest, is it about minorities getting more of the pie? And that's not directly to any one individual person's fears, but about
right.
in the culture.
Right. Or, for me, it's like the idea of losing it is tied to this, like if there's an economic collapse or something, and
but you know, the economic if we have an economic collapse, I think it's going to be mirroring a much more fundamental collapse, which is of our mythology, and that leads, you know, back to some of the questions you asked a while ago, which I suggested we might deal with toward the end of this conversation, and
which we're getting towards.
Yeah,
throwing a few thoughts on that matter. One thing I do not want anyone to leave listening to this conversation or reading my book with is the notion that I'm simply trashing America. That serves no purpose.
I mean, wouldn't you say that every nation and every culture has its own set of myths that probably aren't true? Their own.
Well, again, I mean, the notion of what's true is that's not important. The
right.
notion, the idea is, why are we telling ourselves these stories?
Right. I mean,
I want to suggest that people across the world, in every every country across the world, know perfectly well what the American Empire has been perpetrating in their countries, and at the same time, for 400 years and no less now. People are desperate in from every country in the world to come here, to come to America, and you know, this is what I want to leave you with as we begin to approach the end of the hour. America has been broadcasting to the world for 400 years this notion of opportunity, and I think when people have been desperate for generation after generation to get to America, it's not just because of the notion of making it rich here. I think below that are deeper and much more powerful mythic notions of opportunity. And if we take it a little further, I think eventually one thing we're going to have to do by way of beginning to evolve new myths, one of the things we're going to have to do is begin to go deeper into our own myth. And if we cook away the unnecessary parts of it and the parts of it that have been detrimental to us, I think what we'll find, and this may take a very long time, but I think what we'll find is at the very core of our American story is something beautiful, and that is perhaps the most basic mythic image of all, which is of the new start, rebirth, within a cycle of not a linear story, but a cycle of birth, death, and rebirth. And I think that this is what has been attracting people to our shores all of these centuries. The idea of leaving behind a story that doesn't work anymore and coming to this new land, and so-called new land, and starting all over with a new story. And so I think this is the real essence of the power of our story that's been attracting us all these years and attracting other people. And I think this is the great opportunity, not just with Occupy, but in notions of whatever may be happening in the next 5 or 10 or 20 years, that as the old myth collapses, we might have the opportunity to look at its very essence and see that it has something really
Well, Barry, we only have a couple of minutes left. I want to remind our listeners that we've been speaking with Barry Spector, author of Madness at the Gates of the City, The Myth of American Innocence. And do you have, and this is published by Regent Press out of Berkeley, California, do you have a website and contact information you'd like to share?
Yeah, thanks. As always, I recommend patronizing your independent local bookstores, but if you can't do that, it's available on Amazon. I do have a website for the book with many sample chapters that you can download for free and many other essays of mine, and that website is www.madnessatthegates.com. I also have another website that for the work that my wife and I do together. That is Barry and Maya, M-A-Y-A, Spector, S-P-E-C-T-O-R.com. If you go to either of those websites, you can get connections to my blogs as well. So what I'm really trying to do here, and thanks for asking, is offer listeners and readers the notion that we can begin to think in mythological terms once again, as our ancestors all did many, many generations ago. And I think when we begin to ask the big questions of the myths in our culture, we'll begin to get we'll start telling more stories and telling more poems and sharing more art together and rebuilding what I call the creative imagination. So I think folks can get a lot of directions toward this kind of thinking on my website and, of course, in reading the book.
And the book is very, what would you say, it goes very deeply. We've only kind of grazed the surface here in this conversation today, and the book goes much, much deeper and really talks about some of the mythical archetypes and how they're being played out in our own culture and how it's affecting us. And always ties back to kind of the origins, both in our culture and in Greek mythology, of these myths. And so there's a lot to sink your teeth into. So thank you so much for being with us here today on Writers' Voices, Barry.
Thanks for having me, and I'm just glad to be able to to speak to some folks who aren't more or less in, a listenership that might not be in total agreement with me. Speaking on the radio in the Bay Area, I feel like I'm speaking to the choir to some extent. I'd love to get feedback. If people can get my email by looking at the website, and I encourage questions and arguments.
Great. Well, thank you. And that's it for Writers' Voices today, and except for a quote from
yes.
Caroline.
Well, I have a lot of good ones. This one, though, I thought was interesting. This was Robertson Davies. The world is full of people whose notion of a satisfactory future is, in fact, a return to the idealized past.
Mm. Very good.
Yep. And stay tuned now if you're listening on Friday. On Planet Erstwhile today, James Moore presents a special Free Speech Radio News report on Arundhati Roy's coverage of indigenous tribes in India and interviews with Richard Cohen of The Washington Post, Sam Husseini, Communications Director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, and his regular 4 p.m. segment Inside the Headlines with J.P. Sotili. And see you next week on Writers' Voices.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.